the second to last factor in this transcendent dependent origination is liberation, is release. And I'd like to tell you a little story that I like from the ancient texts about a monk who was known or was to be an arhat, fully awakened, fully liberated. And he was traveling about the countryside with other monks, and they came upon a river to cross. And so it was relatively shallow, so they could walk across. And so this arhat, he pulled up his robes high. Now, you know, monks don't wear underwear. So I don't know how high it was. And then he pranced across the river in the most undecorous way, unmonk-like. So the other monks, given human nature, went back to the Buddha to say, wait a minute, you know, he's supposed to be arhat, but let us tell you how he behaved. And now we certainly know who's not liberated. One of my, to go take a tangent, another favorite rule for the monastics time is that you eat your food in a bowl, you know, alms bowl, and, you know, people put all kinds of food in. They put dessert in and salads and whatever. And so, you know, if you ate it according to convention, you'd have the appetizer first and then the salad, maybe then the main course and then the dessert, right? But the rule for the monastics is when you dip your spoon into the bowl, you should have no preferences in what you eat. Just pick it up as it comes out. So, but my favorite rule is the second one after this, and that is that you're not allowed to look into the bowl of the other monk to see how he's doing. And that was great. So they went back to the Buddha and complained about this so-called arhat who was prancing in the most undecorous way across the river. And you know, what's going on? You know, he's supposed to be an arhat. And the Buddha said, oh, certainly he's an arhat. He's fully liberated. However, for the 500 previous lifetimes, he was a monkey. And the monkey nature still comes across sometimes. Still carry, you know. So maybe you have monkey nature. Or porcupine nature. Or salamander nature. Or groundhog nature. Who knows, you know, what you've been for 500 lifetimes and what you carry with you. So this is kind of a mythic way of saying that you get to be who you are. Liberation means you get to be who you are. You don't need to pretend or be someone else's idea of what it means to be free. As some of you know, also the analogy I like to use is if two people spend a long time in prison together, in the same prison, they have very much the same experience of being in prison. But then on the same day they get released from prison, in the next hours and days and months and years, their experiences can be very different from each other as they follow causes and conditions, their nature, their interests. And so we can get liberated, we can become freed of the prisons we're in. And then we want to be very careful not to put ourselves into a new prison, the idea of what we're supposed to be like after that. It's possible, maybe, that you're quirky. You're unique. You're not completely, perfectly conventional human being. It's just possible. You're not just like the perfect embodiment of the average, normal human being. Might that be possible? Just a little bit, maybe? You know, you might be really close, but just a little bit off. No one knows what a normal human being is. But this idea of the monkey nature and the arhat, you get to be who you are when you come out of prison. Don't put yourself in a new prison. Certainly don't put yourself in a Buddhist prison. You know, you have to be a good Buddhist. Also fond of, there's a discourse in the middle length discourses where I gather, it's a beautiful full moon night in a grove of trees, and some of the senior disciples of the Buddha are sitting around, and they ask each other a question. They said, who is it who can light up this grove like the full moon lights it up? What kind of person can, you know, shines, radiance in this kind of beautiful way, like the full moon? And they go around, all these disciples, and they all give an answer. And the answer turns out that they all answer it according to their own personality and specialty and who they are. The one who's done a lot of learning, the one who learns a lot shines. The one who has a lot of meditation practice, the one who meditates a lot shines. The one who has psychic powers, that's the one who has psychic power, you know, it goes on, they all kind of, you know, that's the one. And then they come to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, you're all right, all of you. And I love it that they just kind of described how they were. They probably recognize other ways, but maybe it was a kind of way of honoring your way. It's okay. So to be liberated, this series of things and dependent arising of the steps for liberation could maybe be better understood if we kind of say it in the opposite way by saying, what has to be there for us not to be free? What are the conditions for being in prison, caught? And so, doubt, the opposite of faith. There's a lot of discouraging doubt. It's hard to get liberated, be free. If we're grim, grimness is not conducive to freedom. What's the opposite of joy here? Dour? If we're dour, or maybe depressed, if we are agitated and running in circles in our mind and fretting in our mind, hyped up, It's hard to become free, be free from that prison. If we are unhappy, difficult, or if we have misery, it's difficult to be free. If we're the opposite of steady in the mind, concentrated, if we are scattered and caught up and spinning in our mind, it's not conducive towards freedom. And if we don't see clearly this life that we live in, if we're deluded or we have blinders on or we're not paying attention to this life in a careful way, it's hard to be free. And then the opposite of disenchantment for this purposes today may be, certainly you could say enchantment. But I think that if we're caught up, if we're kind of glued to our desires and our fears and our beliefs, it's hard to be free because it's like the opposite of being free, right? You're caught in those things. Dispassionate is kind of more clearly kind of like, you know, the opposite of being attached, being clinging. So in the context of all these things that really represent the state of being in prison, state of being caught, and state of suffering, those are the conditions for further suffering. Maybe there's a different perspective now on these steps in transcendent dependent origination, that they have a role. You can see that they have a place because the opposite is clearly doesn't work. And to know that that there's a fork in the road, to know there's different options. And one option can lead to more suffering, and one option leads to happiness or freedom, is a very important piece of wisdom. Because if we don't not clear about this fork, then it's all too easy to go down the wrong fork. If we want to be free, to go down the fork of greater freedom. And I think people who do Buddhist practice sometimes will, in the context of Buddhism, will take down the walk down the fork of greater being imprisoned rather than free. If the purpose of Buddhism is to become free of suffering, ideally you wouldn't suffer because of Buddhism. The idea is to hold Buddhism kind of lightly, but not get too serious about it. Certainly to take yourself seriously. I think I feel that the Dharma is offered in the context of a tremendous respect for you. To the Buddha, the way he taught, the way he encountered people and related to people. And I think the way it's offered, the Buddhism, is to a lot of respect that sometimes maybe gets hidden behind the teachings of like not self, because it's kind of implies you don't count somehow, you're not supposed to be here. It's a mistake to be here as a self, so. But really, the tremendous respect and if we take the Buddha as an example, he's a person who had tremendous confidence. Person who kind of stood in a sense and kind of a tall and was willing to kind of talk to anybody who came and had a certain had a dignity, uprightness. Maybe he understood about not self, but he was a powerful person. And so for you also, you get to be yourself and to respect yourself and to be respected and even better, to be loved. It's hard to, one of the consequences I feel of my years of practice is the idea, how can we not love each other? How can we not have respect for each other, for this life that's difficult to live and this wonderfulness of being a human being? And I think you know, everyone's trying their best, finding their way. And I think the respect that Buddhism has for the individual is that there's a kind of a trust that if you hand people the ability to learn to trust themselves and to pay attention to themselves deeply and find out what's really going on, the inner voices, inner drives and desires, that in that there's something in our system that knows it wants to be free, wants to find the way. I think the simple reason for that is that all the ways in which we get that gets in the way of our love and gets in the way of our freedom and gets in the way of are all kind of obscurations. It's all kind of like extra. It's all this activity of the mind, hating and wanting, and the mind is busy with those things. When the mind is quiet, then the heart can be full. The heart can radiate and be. And it's in the context of this, you know, respect and maybe love for ourselves and for each other that it's kind of the context for liberation. And rather than seeing liberation as being difficult to understand idea, concept, you know, some kind of grand, beautiful state of consciousness or cosmic consciousness or some great experience of emptiness that no one knows what it is quite. Over and over again in the early tradition, the emphasis is to define liberation as the absence of greed, hate, and delusion. And what's nice about this is that an absence of those, it's kind of like, then we're out of prison. Then you get to live your life. Who knows how you're going to live your life? But as long as those are there, you're in prison. And so to begin to find a way to loosen the grip of our attachments, our clinging, our fears, the ways we clamp down, get contracted, this can be a beautiful thing. It can be a beautiful kind of movement of the heart and the mind to walk on that path, to do that. And one of the things I celebrate a lot, I think is so special, so wonderful, is simply having a path to walk that leads this way. Independent of how far we get, just, wow, so lucky to be on a path to freedom. So not to get caught up too much on how far we've come. And There was a, for me, a kind of a touching story that I've been told a number of times now by people who were there. And Dalai Lama was at a conference, or was giving a teaching, I think in Arizona, you know, with lots of people come, big auditorium, and I think it was a multi-day teaching, the way he does. And there was a time for questions, and someone stood up and asked about how you could get enlightened quickly. And the way it was told to me was that the Dalai Lama paused for a very long time, and he even started to tear and cry at the question. I don't quite exactly remember the explanation afterwards, but he was not happy with that question, because it felt maybe, I don't know if he thought it was greedy for that, but it's more of the selfing and wanting and getting. And there's something very respectful about oneself in this life, where we're not in a hurry. We're taking the steps. We have the sincerity. We have our sincerity, engagement, and we're walking the path. And I think that there's liberation to be found on every step we take. To be too much involved in some of the big ideas of what liberation is, I think kind of we miss ourselves. We lose ourselves too much, too easily. But to appreciate that there's liberation in the next step that we take. And literally in our steps, if you watch how you walk, sometimes, watch how you walk to a meal at retreat. Or if they put out cookies or ice cream as you go by to wash your hands, what happens to your steps? Are you really free, or are you kind of like eyeing the ice cream and seeing, do they have your flavor and what they do, and you calculate how many people are in front of you in the line, and you begin strategizing, see if you can cut in front, and what if you just don't serve any other food, but just kind of jump to the end, and before everybody else just gets, lunch can just be ice cream. So how do you walk at each step? Where are you? What's driving you? What are you caught by anything? Are you really there in that step and that moment? Freedom can be found there. Perhaps freedom is found in not adding second arrows or third arrows to what's happening for you. Perhaps you are caught by something. Your mind is attached, caught up. And maybe that liberation in that moment is just to be at ease with that, not add more prisons around it, more self. And I think there's something there, I think it's really profound to have a willingness and contentment to look for the simple liberations in the next moment, this moment, here. And perhaps it's really the accumulation of doing that in the small moments that builds the foundation for some of the larger freedoms that we can find in Buddhism. Some of the more clear ways in which we get classic ways of liberation. There's a wonderful list of the four clingings that we get liberated from through the practice. And I'll offer you them in a kind of, I think it's reverse order of how these are usually listed, just so that you maybe approve it early, the first parts. So the first one in this reversed order is the attachment or clinging to precepts, rituals, and religious practices. Now I tell you. It's So that's a place where people get very attached. Not that any of these things are not good and useful, but it's the attachment of clinging to it which can be a source of suffering. And to think that, you know, religious practices or religious behavior or rituals, that's where freedom is found in and of itself, can obscure or prevent us from really seeing what's going on in our own hearts and minds, and to find the freedom there. The second clinging is the clinging to conventional or kind of colloquial English, maybe it would be clinging to our stories. In the old language, it was the clinging to views. But many of our stories are just views. So we have all these opinions about views and ideas and who we are and what has to be and what's right and what's wrong and what happened and who did what to who and and not that some of these aren't views and opinions are not right, but it's the clinging to them and the attachment to it which is a source of a lot of suffering. Then there's a clinging to self, clinging to the way that we want to represent ourselves to others or present ourselves to ourselves, clinging to what we think the self needs, who I am, who I'm not. You know, it's fascinating how much we can cling to negative images of ourselves, attached to ideas that we're a victim or attached to the idea that we're somehow unworthy or bad or wrong. You know, so interesting that conceit in Buddhism equally means thinking you're worse than others as it does thinking you're better than others. To be involved in the whole selfing game of comparing yourself to others is something that Buddhism hopes to get you free from. No need to compare. That's why I wanted to start the story with this story of the Arhat. Because of the, you know, you get to be who you are in some deep way. No need to compare. And then the last of the four clingings is clinging to sensual pleasure. And I kind of put it last, even though on the usual list it's first, because I have suspect that a lot of people are more likely to complain about this one than the other three. The Buddhists, they're so against life. Life denying people, pleasure somehow wrong. You're supposed to renounce. Party pooping Buddhists. But it's not that sensual pleasure is wrong, it's the attachment to it, the clinging to it. And it's really insidious, it's really deep in the human psyche and human beings' lives, how much sensual pleasure in one way or the other plays a very powerful role in how we live our life and what we do. Even people who don't think that they're sensualists, it's often there in the choices they make, going to the store and buying food. Do you buy the absolutely basic, simple necessities for sustenance of your life? Or is there pleasure somehow connected in the choice of what you buy? Do you buy the most functional, simple, cheapest, enduring clothes you can possibly buy? Or do you buy clothes partly because of the sensual pleasure that provides? How you decorate your home, or even the home that you rent or buy, you know, is it more than what's basically needed for just a good life? And if so, chances are that there's some kind of sensual pleasure, desire that's operating there. It's not bad, it's not wrong, but it's certainly a place to look, to notice. Are you caught in sensual pleasure, caught in the desire for it? Is it, how strongly is it? And is there freedom? And which would you rather have? Do you rather have freedom or sensual pleasure? Someone today said something like, I wasn't so interested in all these states, special states, the states of transcendent dependent origination. So I asked, well, what's better than those states? And not wanting them. I thought that was great. That's better, not want them, than to have them. Because there's freedom found in not wanting. There's freedom found in, so what I heard in that was the sense of freedom. Open hands open, the mind open, just with this here. As opposed to wanting, and wanting can cause a lot of suffering. So these four clingings, clinging to precepts and practices and rituals, clinging to opinions and stories and views, clinging to self, self-identity, and clinging to sensual pleasure, is kind of the territory that these transcendent dependent origination is operating in. It's finding its way. It's kind of like, as we develop the practice, sooner or later, these are attachments, our clinging, where we're held, where we're tight, where we're constricted, contracted, where there's wind drag. One of my definitions of self, Buddhist idea of self, kind of, self is wind drag. Because if you're caught up in ideas of self, self-identity, it slows things down. It slows the freedom of the mind, the heart down. So as we negotiate the path, walk the path, sooner or later, we encounter the places where it's not easy to go, where we get caught, where we are held back or frightened or attached. And coming to these junctures in the path is not a mistake. It's definitely part of the path. If you're sitting here meditating and notice that you're attached to something, congratulate yourself that you're so lucky. Not that you're lucky to be attached, but you're so lucky that you get to see it. Wow. You've managed to put yourself in a place where you sit and notice that you really get caught. Bow to your caughtness. Fantastic. It's about time I get to see it. It's probably been going around for decades back there. But now I get to look at it and be with it and just get this, And what does it mean to be free at this step? What does it mean to be liberated? And one of the things it means to be liberated when you notice you're attached and caught is not make a big deal of it. It's not a sin to be attached. It's just attached. And then there's ouch usually connected to it. It's just very simple. So maybe the next step of liberation is just to, in a certain kind of way, be liberated from your, not liberated from, like it's gone, but liberated with your attachment, with your fear, your desire, and self-preoccupation, or whatever it might be. That's the next step. Oh, just to hold it lightly. Just try to be spacious about it. Try not to make a big deal of it. Not to add stories and views and opinions on top of it. Not to get involved in selfing around it. So where is the liberation found here, in this moment? And the question like that, where is the liberation now, what is the liberation that I can touch into now? what's available for me to me right now? Maybe just what's a small step of freedom? This moment's freedom. Sit in here and be impatient for the ending of the sitting. Where's the freedom there? Maybe the freedom there is just to be clearly mindful, really be mindful, oh, this is impatience. And there's something freedom in just recognizing and seeing it. Or maybe the freedom is to recognize that there's a contraction in the shoulders or in the throat with impatience. And maybe the freedom is found just relaxing the physical contraction. Or maybe it's noticing that the impatience is derived from some strong desire to do something different or some strong aversion to what's happening. And if you can really see the desire or the aversion, maybe that lets up, it loosens up, it doesn't grab you. So freedom is found there. The momentary freedoms. This moment. And then the transcendent dependent origination, these different steps, can be there in the background for whatever ones that you remember, to know that there are these wholesome, good states, states of goodness, that are a reference point for what's possible or kind of the direction we're kind of going. We are, in fact, going in the direction of being happier. So it's kind of like a signpost, or kind of like a little indication of the direction. Yes, it's towards happiness, in case you start going down the unhappy direction too much. But the transcendent dependent origination is also a process of letting the mind become quieter, the mental formations, a stilling, a quieting. And as I said in the beginning of the retreat, if you're mindful enough to watch your thinking mind, even having good thoughts, there's a certain kind of tiredness and even alienation that can come from thinking too much and a lot. And so this process of the transcendent dependent origination is a process of one condition, one state, supports us to relax and settle in and trust more fully. So we don't have to be so busy and active in the mind. Faith, trust, supports relaxation, steadying a lot. Delight and joy helps us to relax, and feel safe, and to be here. To trust that we don't have to do a lot. We don't have to manufacture or make things happen. Or it's okay. It's okay to just be. The wonderful gift of just to be here. And if we are afraid, one of the great things to do with fear that simplifies things and helps with this quieting is to see if you can help your fear feel safe. How can you help your fear feel safe? And there's not a few people I meet who are at war with their fear, or attacking it, or criticizing it, or trying to fix it. And I mean, the poor fear, it's got poked and prodded and, you know, and pushed away and dismissed and made feel shameful and all kinds of things we do with fear. How do you make your fear feel safe? And as the fear feels safe, the mind can get quieter. So this movement towards letting the mind become quieter, it's not, it means that your mind gets dull, it doesn't mean the mind gets sleepy. It's actually, the idea is a clear and still mind. The image that's given sometimes is of an unwavering candle flame. It doesn't move, you know, conventionally doesn't move, but it's alive and vital inside. It's just, you know, it's a lot of energy there. So the mind that gets still in mindfulness and practice, it's also a mind that gets clear and vital. It's kind of becomes more alive than anything that we can think about. In fact, thinking somehow feels like an alienation, disconnection from a vitality and aliveness, clarity. That's more who we are. So things get quieter, stiller. And I've noticed that, you know, thinking, and it's kind of hard to find the mute button for our thinking. It'd be nice if there was a mute button, right? Just once and for all. But one of the many people find that what happens on, as they, like on retreat, is that over time, the thinking gets thinner. It's not as heavy or strong. Like, you know, sometimes thinking is like the most solid thing in the world. What could be more important than what we think, you know? But over time, the thinking just gets lighter, weaker. We're not so invested in it and so caught in it. And slowly, slowly, our thinking gets thinner and thinner, quieter, more transparent. Maybe there's more gaps between our thoughts. And as they get weaker or thinner, the thinking, they don't grab us around by the throat anymore. We're not so invested or caught in them. And they're like kind of just floating more. An image that's given in Buddhism for thoughts is clouds drifting in an endless sky. And sometimes, you know, it's like pretty overcast. But as the clouds clear, and, you know, it gets just a few little clouds. So maybe just end just one little cloud drifting by. Maybe even that one little cloud begins to fade away. But there's this movement towards stilling, quieting, thinning. And one of process, you know, is a process that follows in the wake of doing this little momentary liberations. This moment here. Being here fully for this. One of the wishes I have for these talks is to really try to point you back to the immediacy of your own experience. Here. And then the mindfulness of this, the little liberation of this moment. This moment's liberation from being involved in your thoughts. Maybe just letting go of the thoughts or stepping back or letting it be and not being without being involved. And generally, this is a very, there's a lot of satisfaction, a lot of feeling of rightness in this movement of the thinning and quieting. And some of this happens, you know, happens when we start really seeing clearly things as they are. We see things as in their impermanent nature, see them as unsatisfactory, or see, you know, it doesn't make sense to be caught up around making self out of this. And not that these things are challenges to see this, but rather the opposites. Oh yeah, because it's impermanent, I can relax. I don't have to do so much about it. I don't have to chase the unsatisfactory world and make it satisfactory. And there's a paradox, you know, the more we see the unsatisfactoriness of things, the more satisfactory that insight is, the more it feels right, more a sense of rightness in this coming home to ourselves and settling here and being here. And there's very little need to think and to fix and to plan and explain and defend. And there can be a contentment just to be here, now. So with time there's a kind of thinning and quieting and a stilling of the mental formations that goes on. Sometimes it feels like there's very little left, and sometimes our life comes roaring back, and then other times it gets quiet again, then it comes back. But to appreciate the quieting, the stilling, to appreciate that world, inner world, which is behind or underneath the world of thinking, so we don't give too much attention to our thoughts. Thoughts like clouds. There's a Chinese poet named Li Po who wrote a poem that goes something like this. The birds have vanished from the sky. And the last cloud is fading away. We sit here, the mountain and I, until there is only the mountain. We sit here, the mountain and I, until there is only the mountain. And this poem describes this process of stilling, quieting. First the birds go, and the clouds go, and the solidity and stability of the mountain, just here. And then I disappear, you disappear. And this mountain remains, beautiful mountain. Just as a mountain is one of the most stable things usually around, maybe solid, triangular pyramid of a mountain, represents stability and magic. In a similar way, liberation, freedom, non-clinging, is the safest place to be. That's where the ultimate safety is found, is in not clinging.